This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Zoltan Isfahan. Zoltan, it's great having you back on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Hey.
Zoltan, the last time we talked, you were running for president. Can you talk about how your campaign went?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I had one of the longest campaigns out there, 731 days. I ran under the banner of the Transhumanist Party, which is a small political party dedicated to radical science and technology. And, you know, for some strange reason, the campaign became very popular very early on. And so I ran as certainly one of the most visible presidential candidates through the entire 2 years in terms of media attention. Apparently, there was never really a science candidate before me, or a kind of a non-religious candidate. You know, that was another emphasis of mine. And so there was a lot of press. But, you know, in terms of votes, we did very poor, or we don't even know exactly how we did because we never were able to get on any state ballots because basically if you're not a major party or even a major third party, you really can't make any ground when it comes to that because of the different ways that the states keep third-party candidates off.
And you're running for governor as a libertarian in 2018, and you also have a proposal for a California state basic income. Is this proposal tied to the run for governor?
Yes, absolutely. The basic income is a libertarian version, and it's absolutely tied to my governor run. In fact, it's my main policy platform. I'd say, you know, the strongest thing I got going. And yeah, this time I am running for the Libertarian Party. It makes a lot more sense. I will be on the ballot. You will have an opportunity to vote for me. There's a lot of infrastructure in place. And while most people wouldn't consider a basic income libertarian, there are ways to make a basic income libertarian. And I've done just that. And I hope it's going to go over very well in California. I'm definitely one of the top seven candidates right now.
And this basic income, it will be necessary in the future. Automation is going to replace a lot of jobs, and this ties in with your issues with transhumanism.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm sure your audience knows what transhumanism is, but it's basically, you know, using radical science and technology to kind of improve the human being. But it oftentimes means a lot of automation, a lot of robots, a lot of artificial intelligence. And I'm quite convinced that no matter what happens over the next 10 or 20 years, unless there's like a war and we get sent backwards somehow to civilization, you know, jobs are going to be, robots are going to be taking jobs. They're going to be taking most of the jobs. It doesn't matter if you're a podcaster, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, in construction, doesn't matter if you're a doctor, doesn't matter if you're a taxi driver. There's really just simply no way to compete against the kinds of machines that are going to be produced here over the next 10 or 20 years. And so basically everybody needs to be prepared that they may lose their job due to automation, which presents an enormous conflict, not only of interest, but also a conflict in just human society. How far do we take this machine and robot enhancements, you know, all across the world? Does that leave us with revolution because people can't feed themselves? Or does the, you know, do countries and United States figure out a basic income so that people whose jobs have been replaced can still eat, have food, raise children, and the basics? It's a very complicated time that we're entering here over the next decade or two.
Your article on a basic income, this is based on the revenue from federal lands and resources. You talk about the U.S. government owning $150 trillion worth of land. And you talk about if you divide it by the nation's citizens, you get basically it's about $500,000 per person. So are you... But your proposal is on a state level. Your article was focused more on the nationwide statistics.
Well, yes. Yeah, so, you know, just, you know, in all honesty, I am, of course, running to win the governor's race. But in California, which is a very Democrat state, there's very little chance. So what my governor run is really trying to do is run up to the 2020 presidential nomination for the Libertarian Party. So I'm trying to create, some momentum here already with this gubernatorial run. And, you know, then even then, my basic platform is still going to continue to be this basic income, because what's happening is with so much automation, jobs are going to be threatened, society is going to be threatened, everything. But the main point of it is that this is a libertarian version of a basic income. This is not a let's tax the rich and, you know, give the money to the poor. That's not this type of basic income at all. This basic income is based on a very single premise. The American government is holding approximately $150 trillion worth of land, and that's a conservative estimate. I want to point out that some experts go as high as $180 trillion to $220 trillion worth of federal land and fossil fuels and things like that. America is worth a lot. And if you take the western part of 11 states, you essentially are holding on to amazing amounts of federal land that is unoccupied, unused, and unattended to, essentially. And that land belongs to the people. That land, you know, is not the government's. It's just been put in a trust by the government. That belongs to you and I. And if you divide that land, about 600 million acres, and in California alone, just 45 million acres. I mean, half of California is almost empty land. And you divide this, you know, federal land by every American citizen, 325 million of us, you get about $500,000 a person. And my idea is, let's not just sell it outright. Why don't we try to lease it? And if we can lease it, then we can give everybody a certain income per month, and those leases can renew themselves over time, and, you know, we can decide how we want to do that lease. But the bottom line is, that way, no matter if the robots take our jobs, people are still going to have money to eat, to have housing, to feed themselves, to have children, and to continue on with their lives, whether or not they can work or not.
With the leasing out of the land, are you talking about logging and drilling for oil, and how do you address those environmental concerns?
So that is the million-dollar question, really, about my plan. And my plan is called the Federal Land Dividend. You know, it's obviously, a lot of people refer to it as the basic income, but honestly, I'm trying to avoid the basic income word, because it's not exactly free money. These are resources that belong to the American people, all 325 million of us. So I like to think of it as just something that we're getting back, or taking back from the government in a very libertarian-esque kind of way. It could be, but, you know, how do we use the land? How do we lease out? Well, it could be anything. Let's just take California, for example. If you've ever driven down Highway 1 or 101, you realize that, wow, huge tracts of California along the coast is just empty nature land. And while it's very beautiful, it's also worth trillions and trillions of dollars, certainly much more than the California debt is right now. And why not give that to the developers? Well, right now you can't, because the Coastal Commission, which is almost like a crime syndicate, is holding in this, you know, arm holding it down and saying, look, you can't develop this. Well, I think we should be able to develop. I think the developers should be able to lease out that land and build malls and build houses and let everybody have an ocean view. I mean, this is amazing amounts of land. That's just one example of kind of the what we can do to generate some income. Of course, there's going to be plenty of oil. There's going to be plenty of logging in Oregon. You have huge tracts of land. And let's take a look at Nevada. Nevada is a very small population, only occupies like 5% of the state. When we have about as many resources, mineral resources in Nevada as there's in Afghanistan. The only difference is we're not fighting a trillion-dollar war in Afghanistan as we've been, you know, kind of doing over the 10 years now, approximately. So why not just take those resources from Nevada, where it belongs to us? It's so much simpler. So these are the kinds of ways that we can tap into that wealth of the federal land that the government has and give it back to the people, without actually causing a bunch of chaos and without taxing the rich. In fact, this is going to make the rich richer, and this is going to give the poor a kind of a stepping stone so that they can also, you know, have resources and food and shelter and things like this. This is a bipartisan idea, and that's why I think Congress will appreciate it.
Is there a clause that says that requires companies to leave the land environment just as they found it, where their lease is over? This is in regards to leasing out federal land to private companies.
Yes, 100%. There's basically two big clauses. The first is that no national parks would get touched with this with this plan. And I know in a very early version, I had not really worked out a lot of the details when we had released some of the news on this. But now, you know, as me and my staff have been going over and saying, okay, this is what we could do, this is what we couldn't do. Well, one thing is for sure, no national parks and my federal land dividend would be touched. So people would always be able to go out to Yosemite or to nature and do this thing. And the second is that if you, you know, this is the way we're trying to appeal to the environmentalists, because, you know, all in all, you don't want to have a huge group of people, especially in California, where everyone's very strongly environmental oriented. You want to appeal to them. And so you want to say, look, if, for example, you take, you know, 2 million acres and you lease it out to, let's say, Exxon or something like that, and it's for oil reserves. Well, in 35 years, if that's how long the lease is, they have to promise to return that that nature, you know, to exactly what it was. Now, of course, they're not going to be able to replenish the oil, but they can certainly make the landscape look just like it was and put in, you know, the kind of, I guess, beautify it into the way it was when they first took it over. And I think if we can do that, then we can promise the American people that we're not destroying America. We're just tapping into its resources and then giving the money out to the people itself. But that's a very important point of it, that whenever that lease ends, you have to restore that land to what it was before.
And you were talking about open space along Highway 1. Most of that is state parks. If you were to sell that to private developers, wouldn't you be permanently changing that area from wilderness to a suburban area?
Well, you know, when you talk about state parks, there's a huge amount of, you know, differentiation between that. Some of it is state parks and some of it is just state land. And then some of it is under other different types of jurisdictions that are kind of like somewhere in between. And, you know, there's a lot of little state parks along the coast. And I think, you know, those things would probably not be touched because they're minimal. But when you're talking about some of the larger ones, and again, it's not that you would just say, okay, go in and log the whole thing. You know, this is where I think you could get into the nitty gritty of what Congress would do and say, well, this is what we could allow, this is what we couldn't allow. You know, maybe the basic income isn't going to be as much money as I would hope it to be. You know, right now I had promised every American approximately like $20,000, $22,000, $24,000 based on 75% of the federal land leasing itself. And in California, I had promised about $57,000 based on 75% of the land being leased. But maybe it wouldn't be that much. Maybe people would say, well, we care more about trees and nature than we thought. And so only half of that's going to be done. For me, and then, you know, your basic income would only be $1,000 a month or something. For me, what's very, very important, though, is that we have a problem. We have a dire problem with automation. And we want to be very careful that we don't just all of a sudden tax the very rich, because that could crumble the economy even more than this whole automation thing is going to happen. So we have to come up with a plan that works for both the Democrats, conservatives, for the libertarians, for the Greens, for everybody involved. And that's where I think what we're sitting on, you know, $150 trillion worth of land in California, about $15 to $20 trillion worth of land. Let's start using some of it to pay for people's health, to pay for people's lives, pay for people's food. You know, California has basically the highest poverty rate in the nation in terms of the amount of people. We have 19 million people in California that are living right at the poverty line, below it or above it, at about $24,000 a year. That's a huge amount of people at the poverty line. We should do better than that when we have all these resources.
What do you think about the issue of using oil revenue for basic income? Alaska does that, and it's a fairly small amount. Would you support like a complete nationalization of California's oil resources and putting it all towards a basic income or like a partial basic income?
Well, I would definitely not support any nationalization of anything at this point. What I would support, though, is giving or leasing out this land or selling it outright. I mean, people have said, "Result, we don't like your leasing plan. Let's sell it." And I thought, okay, well, if that's the way to make this happen, certainly some of it could be sold. I wouldn't be, you know, up for selling all of America, I don't think, at first. Certainly not, of course, the national parks. But, you know, if we are selling it to other American corporations, then and there was this kind of promise that that money was going to the people itself, not just to the rich. The last thing I want to do is make the rich richer. It's not that I don't want to make the rich richer. What I want to do is just make sure that equality grows through the sale of this land, because what's happening is inequality is growing all the way around America. And frankly, I don't see any way that it's going to get better without some type of civil strife or even a revolution. So we need to tap into that land and make sure that we can kind of, you know, utilize it for all people, every single citizen. And I think, you know, I like the way the oil revenues come from Alaska. I don't actually know that much detail about it because it's a kind of a small amount. Yes, it's nice to, in the end of the day, to have a $2,000 check or whatever it is, pay for Christmas presents and going out, some vacations. But what I'm trying to propose is something that can actually offset the massive amounts of automation that's going to take your job. I'm looking for something to 100% replace your job in itself so that you can now have endless amounts of free time and still be able to live, eat, have a roof over your head, raise a family, and live a life. And that's something that's quite different than Alaska. The amount of money coming from, you know, the $2,000 that people get in Alaska is just not enough to, you know, it supplements their income, but it's not enough to even close to live on.
So you think in the long run, basic income will basically have to provide a basic middle-class living for most Americans?
Yes, I think it has to. I mean, you know, this is when you get to this point, you know, my presidential campaign, I was going across the country and touring in buses and, you know, that kind of thing. I met a lot of truck drivers. There's about 3.5 or 4 million truck drivers in America. And we already have driverless trucks that, you know, ones have just crossed Europe a few months ago and we have them, we're testing them all over America right now. We are talking about 3.5, 4 million truck driving jobs just being lost in the next 3-4 years potentially. And they will be lost because companies want to make more money, and this is going to come down to that. So what do you do with these people who have really only been trained for one job, if they've been trained at all for that job, but they're experts at that job? You can't retrain them because by the time you retrain them, robots are going to take the next job that they trained for. So you're talking about a bunch of, you know, strong-minded men, many of them who love guns, and losing their jobs. What are you going to do with 4 million grown men who carry guns, who have lost their jobs? We are coming to the point where we're going to have not just civil strife, but probably some sort of civil revolution, unless we can come up with a plan that says to these people that lost your jobs, I know you lost it, but we're providing you with this type of income. The new American dream is not necessarily working really hard. You might just be enjoying yourself. And we're going to try to provide, I don't know if it's going to be the exact same amount of money you earned when you were driving a truck, but it's going to be enough to raise your family and to enjoy yourselves. And we're going to have to get used to a revised version of the American dream. And in fact, it's not just America. It's all around the world. This is a globalization, and the technological revolution is going to change everything here very, very quickly. You know, even by the end of Trump's administration, you know, he says, oh, it's the immigrants who took the jobs. It's automation. It's technology that has taken the jobs. And that's going to be already a hot button topic in the 2020 presidential elections.
With examples of utilizing land, what are some specific examples of utilizing the land to generate revenue? And can those provide jobs as well?
Absolutely. You know, first off, we can just utilize a lot of the lands just better with public use. I mean, right now, it's like half the areas you can't even take your RV, your ATV, your motorcycle through because of all these different restrictions. So that could be people could just pay for more recreational use. But I'm talking about more resource use. Like I said, you know, Nevada is sitting on trillions of dollars of minerals, and we're not tapping that because we like to use, you know, America likes to use other people's nations like Saudi Arabia oil and all these other things. And that's it's a smart policy to, you know, essentially use other people's resources first before we would tap our own. The problem, though, is that what that has led to is a growing amount of inequality because the rich get richer with these corporations and the people in America don't. So right now it's time, in my opinion, with all this automation happening, to restore that wealth to the common American. Let, you know, this is not about the rich. The rich have enough money. This is really about the bottom 50% and saying, we're going to give you something to step on so that you can start all these entrepreneurial activities or not work at all, whatever it's going to be. But we're going to give you back your thing, the thing that belonged to you as an American citizen. So, you know, it could be anything from logging. I mean, there are vast forests in Oregon, Washington. It could be things just like even the fisheries off the, you know, the coast. It could be things just like I said, coastal land and complete development of the West Coast instead of this idea that we should preserve nature so much instead of utilize it. And it could be also little things just like all the different types of fossil fuels and more drilling for oil. You know, these are, I mean, we're already doing that to some extent, but we're not doing it nearly as much as we could. And it's because there's regulation, governmental regulations everywhere. I want to drop a lot of those regulations and restore that that value, that equity to the American people themselves and let them decide how to spend it. And I can assure you they're going to spend it on something that benefits themselves. And they're not going to be worried about the hooded owl or these kinds of things. Not when we have literally tens of millions of people living at the poverty line across America.
Notice in the responses there has been like a strong concern about the environmental concerns, but your point is we can sort of have a discussion, look at each area on a case-by-case basis, where it's located, how much value it has.
Oh, I absolutely believe that. And a lot of people have said, oh, well, if you release all this land all at once, the prices will plummet. Well, I totally agree with that. I'm a real estate developer myself by trade. This is a staggered approach. Automation isn't destroying the economy just yet. It's about this. I mean, it's already been harming, in my opinion, a little bit, but it's going to, every year, it's going to start exponentially growing. So what we'd want to do is take a staggered approach to this land. And of course, this will take, you know, people to say, well, which parts are best? You know, if we have certain tracts of land where we destroy less species than the other type, you know, well, yes. I mean, obviously some of the land in California is probably most pristine with the most amount of species over, let's say, Nevada. So maybe it's, you know, we should go after the minerals in Nevada where we don't have that many species living and where there's very few people living. So that's an easy way to start tapping into these resources while trying to appease to, you know, the environmentalists. And that, because that's going to be the main concern, is that we're going to get a lot of people saying, well, let's not destroy the you know, the country because we want to just make money. But the problem is, if we don't do so, we're going to either have to raise taxes to some absurd amount to pay for welfare, or we're going to have to come up with a system that actually does. And I'd say, when it comes to human beings, we shouldn't worry so much about the environment. We should worry first about human beings, about their health, about where they live, about the, you know, whether their children get the right education. These are priorities for me. And okay, so let me just take one step back, because in my original article, I also try to explain to people, the way we look at the environment now is going to change in the next 10 or 20 years. We're about to be on the verge of creating nanobots, and with all this nanotechnology, with already CRISPR editing or genetic editing, we already have the ability now to grow plants twice as fast and to modify them. Well, that's just now. CRISPR technology has only been around a few years. In 5-10 years, we might have the ability to regrow, you know, forests at 10 times the rate they grow right now. So the idea of replenishing nature, replenishing the environment, making the environment beautiful might become a lot easier in the future here. And that's another thing that I think to consider, is that we can replenish populations like the hooded owl through genetic engineering and not necessarily through, you know, making, you know, putting a big giant fence around these wild, you know, these landscapes so that nobody can get in and destroy the wildlife. I think there are other ways of doing it, scientific, technological ways of protecting the environment. And that would be my way of doing this. So that way we could both protect the environment as well as take care of, you know, the average American who's going to have great hardship from automation.
Your proposal in your article, you have kind of a rough estimate of a $20,000 a year. Do you have an estimate for your California basic income that you would be proposing as your platform for running for governor?
Yes, absolutely. The basic income in California per household would be $56,000. And the way we get that is because we estimate California's land to be worth about $15 trillion. It's probably closer to 20, but $15 to $20 trillion. And then we say, What reasonably could we, you know, how much could we reasonably lease out? You can't just say, I'm going to lease out 100% of it. That's just not the way real estate works. And I thought over a 15 or 20 year period, we might reasonably be able to lease out approximately 50% of it, maybe 60 or 70%. Either way, it would leave all the national parks and leave other parts of the federal land out there that would still be intact. But even if you're leasing 50 to 60% out, you should come up with about per household, and there are 13 million households in California, you know, you would be able to come out with around $50,000 to $55,000 a year per household. Now, that is twice the poverty rate in California. So that is well into a middle-class income for most Californians. And, you know, I can assure you that the 19 million Californians that are living at the poverty line would be very appreciative of that. And again, it doesn't mean that people aren't going to work. It just means that if your job is taken by a robot and now you're making a certain amount of money off some other job, you get to supplement it with this basic income. So it could end up literally eliminating poverty entirely in California. And I think California is a great kind of experimental state to push this forward. See, how does this well? Because it's not like, I don't believe that Congress is going to immediately want to pass such a basic income without trying it out a little bit. We've been trying it out in Alaska. It seems to be working pretty good. Now let's try it on a much larger scale. And of course, that's what my gubernatorial run is about. And if we could be successful, then we could apply it to the national level. And this is why I think, at the very least, it's well worth trying to see how the leasing of federal land goes in order to you know, take care of those who are in poverty.
Do you support having a residency restriction? So say someone has to live in California for a certain amount of years, maybe it's 3 to 5 years for getting this basic income to prevent, say, poor people from other states and moving here en masse?
Yes, absolutely. Look, I'm very pro-immigration, and just coming to get into that sec, and I'm also pro everybody moving to California. But this is we're going to have to put our foot down. This is not a free for all. This is for California people that have been here, that have been working, that have been, you know, that have lost their jobs in California. So there's going to have to be some very strict residency requirements. Otherwise, everybody's in the world is going to move to California. And so we have to be very careful with this up front and be honest with people and say this isn't personal, but this is an experiment in national politics. Is this going to work for the American people? Because there's 325 million people watching, and we only got, you know, 45 million people here in California, and they want to know what's going to happen. So, yeah, there's going to have to be some pretty strict restrictions on who gets that money.
With the whole sort of immigration debate, you brought this up with the Trump's campaign. There's been this debate about immigrants taking jobs, and in the future it's going to be the whole issue of automation. In the future, that will sort of change the narrative because in a labor economy, people are seen as an asset. Do you think that in an economy where everyone needs a basic income and the jobs are automated, will people be seen as a burden and there'll be sort of a push for not needing like extra millions of people?
Well, so, you know, I'll be honest with you, my plan is something that I think is a way to make sure that, you know, this is so controversial, but yeah, my plan is a way to devise to limit the amount of people that we would have here in America. And, you know, I have proposed, for example, in California that my plan only goes to households. And that is going to say that, you know, look, if you have 10 children in your household, that your $55,000 doesn't go as far. I don't want to give it out. You know, in one of my basic income plans, I had said it could be $20,000 per person, but I'm sure Congress would at some point limit that. I mean, imagine you're the octomom and you've had 8 children, and you know, no, Congress is going to pay for all these things to just unlimited do that. There's going to have to be some restrictions, not only on you know, the amount of you know children that you have receiving this, but also on immigration. You can't just cross the border and all of a sudden take, you know, all this money from the government. There's just not enough to do that. And I'm a libertarian, so I'm going to say, look, we have to put our foot down and say, if this is something that is your birthright because you've been here, then it's yours. So yeah, there's going to be some very hard questions to ask, and we just have to be honest with ourselves. Believe me, I'm a very pro immigration person, and I'm pro every, you know, I want everybody to do it exactly what they want, have their children, but there's just not enough resources to go around. And the one thing I'm not going to let this turn into is some socialist, you know, have it all. It wouldn't work that way. We have a limited amount of land. We want to, you know, divide that by the people and make sure that our citizenry thrives because of that. So we're going to have to be careful. And I think that's going to require some tough choices on how we go about doing this federal land dividend. Right now, there's plenty to give everybody a pretty close to a middle class income.
With the whole basic income thing, would this be on top of existing social programs, or do you support cutting Social Security and free healthcare?
oh, I support cutting everything. And that's why this is a libertarian plan, is that you need to go in and just slice up everything. In fact, that's the only way I could actually justify this entire federal land dividend, is because it's going to take out Social Security. It's going to completely wipe out welfare. Food stamps, gone. Socialized medicine, whatever parts we have of it in America, also gone. This is going to mean that private health insurance is truly private. Everybody now has enough money to afford their health care. And there's no reason to say you don't, because you're getting a check from the land. And now it's a competitive market. I would expect health care prices to plummet as it becomes much more competitive. And this is why I really believe this is a very, very strong libertarian plan. We're taking the land that the people own. We're creating a system that it pays us out. And now everybody can live in this age of automation. Yet they're going to still have to be responsible for themselves. And you know, it's wonderful in that sense that you're not going to have to worry about all this welfare or paying higher taxes because of that. In fact, it'll probably lower taxes because all these different bureaucracies will be streamlined and put into one different basket. And that basket is the federal land dividend.
You have some other proposals for your run for governor. One of them is using drones to track people in lieu of prison. How is that different than, say, putting someone on a house arrest with an ankle bracelet?
Well, so, you know, the proposal of doing that, that's not actually a policy of mine that we would track people with drones. It's more just, let's look into some of these other ideas for how we can get people out of prison. Look, I'm not a fan of the prison industry. I know it makes a lot of money, but we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. I'm a guy who wants to legalize all drugs. And, you know, half those people in prison are just in there for marijuana, which is absurd. And, you know, so I feel like, why not get criminals, especially nonviolent criminals, back into the world and working, or at least contributing to society? If drones can do that for very cheap, then that makes a lot more sense to me, because I'd rather have a drug offender back in the workplace contributing his something, even if it's taxes, and then that way we don't have to pay for him to be living in the prison. You know, we have 5,000 prisons across America. We got to do something. This isn't an industry. This is not the way America was supposed to be running its prison industry. We were supposed to be locking up people that were true criminals. And instead, we made an industry out of it that gives incentives to criminalize everybody. And that's not a system I want. And I think drones is a way to get, you know, reasonable people back into the workforce and back to their families.
And you also wrote about the whole issue of privacy. And I think this was for Vice, but your premise was that since basically all private information is available to either the government or to Google or Facebook, you're saying the privacy thing should go both ways. People should also have access to, there should be more transparency, basically, is what your argument was.
Yes, yes. No, and this is closer to policy. Now, I'm not saying that everybody should have, you know, there should be no privacy at all. That's not my policy. But my policy of saying that all government employees should be able to give their entire records over to the public, yes. I think all police officers should always be being filmed what they're doing. And I think government officials, the same thing. I want to know what my government officials are doing, what politicians are doing. And I, you know, this was part of going back to the transhumanist presidential campaign, is I see no reason in the age of technological innovation that we have that we can't watch all our government people. You know, if you're going to sign up like myself to run for one of these things and let's say I get the job, I think it should be completely transparent. There shouldn't be able to go in back doors to third party, you know, to get lobbyists and have, you know, them say, oh, this, and then that way some county gets a bridge. No. This should be a very transparent endeavor. And I think if we had that, the people, even though it may seem like the world is losing its privacy, the people would gain a lot more power. As I've said before, you know, in that article, Big Brother is only Big Brother if you can't watch it. But as soon as you start watching your Big Brother, he's not so big anymore. So it's a two-way street. And that's why I think liberty can be better served by a far less private world. And ultimately, you know, while that may be very, very controversial to many libertarians, I'm not saying they have to give up their privacy. I'm just saying an open world is what is going to create many more liberal values and the kind of values where we have true transparency.
I just want to make a comment with Zoltan just said about like how it's a ingenious, it's a very genius concept to provide a basic income and let like private companies compete for the social services. I've never heard anything like that before.
And this is why I really believe in this idea. And in fact, I've been so excited because over the last 2 months since I presented this idea, it's been catching on. Like the Times of London magazine, you know, mentioned a number of times in a big feature out this weekend. And there's more. I've been had a lot of other people interested in it. And I think for the very first time, you know, we hear a lot about basic income, but we don't discuss anything other than raising the taxes on the rich. But the problem is, let's be honest, the rich are running Congress and everywhere else. Unless we can give them a reason to want to provide a basic income, they may not ever be into it. And even Mark Zuckerberg recently said, yes, it's going to be through natural resources that we're going to do it. And the reason is that the rich are going to want to provide social services as this kind of offshoot of them making more money. They're going to say, yes, fine. You get your basic income, but look at how much our corporations have grown. And that's why I think, you know, this is a really strong bipartisan idea that Congress at some point is going to say, you know what, it makes sense. And the big challenge is really saying how many environmental rules are going to have to be put in place to protect what tracts of land. But I think that's something where, you know, later down the line, you're going to get into the nitty gritty in Congress, and that's what the fight will be over. But the fight's not going to be over the federal land dividend. Everyone's going to agree to it because the wealthy get wealthy, the poor get wealthier. And, you know, again, this is just land that belongs to the people. It's, if you were born here in America or if you're an American citizen, this is your land.
What are your thoughts on the California high-speed rail? Do you support it? And what are your thoughts on the current budget for it?
You know, this is such a tough question because, of course, I support a high-speed rail. Who doesn't? But I don't support the amount of money we spend on it. I don't support the way that it's been built out. And I'm not sure if it's something that needs to be finished anymore or if it needs to be finished in the way that we thought, because there are so many other radical technologies coming on the horizon that I really wonder if it makes sense to have something that takes us 2.5 or 3 hours, so, you know, SF to LA, because you're still going to have security checks. You're still going to have all these other things from where you go, you know, you get at the station, then you got to get to your other location, whether you travel to LA or SF. You know, the fact of the matter is, let's take a look at what automated cars are going to do, or driverless cars. You know, I live here in San Francisco. It takes me about 6.5 hours to drive to Los Angeles. It's the same thing that the high-speed train is going to do. And so it does it in 2.5 hours. However, in 6.5 hours, I get in my car, and instead of, you know, taking a car to that station, which is going to take 45 minutes, and then going through security, which takes another 30 minutes, and then getting on and worrying about, you know, bombs blowing up, whatever else is, you know, the TSA has to worry about. And then you get to your station in LA, and then you have to take a taxi to wherever you're going. By the time you're done, it's a 5 or 6 hour trip. Well, it's 6.5 hours in my car. And the only difference is I don't have to rent a car in LA when I get there because my car is already there. And in fact, I could sleep just as well in my own car as I could on that train. So I think nobody saw how fast driverless cars would come around. And now I'm wondering if we should spend all that extra money on driverless cars, on that technology, on the technology to make so we don't even have traffic anymore in our cities here in California. So, you know, when it comes down to it, I'm not a big supporter of the high-speed rail anymore at all. I know the concept was very romantic when it first started, but nobody saw how fast driverless cars would come. And if it takes 6 hours to get from point A to point B, you know, from the point you're actually going to the point you're finishing in San Francisco, LA, and the state takes 6.5 hours from jumping in my car here, I'm going to go with my own car and then have my own car there. So that's my feelings on that.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to add about your campaign for governor? That's next year in 2018.
Well, I just want to add, thank you for listening. And I think one thing we really should ask a lot more of our candidates is, like, let's ask them to think a little bit more in terms of science and technology. This high-speed rail question is a really good example of how we thought we knew something. Yes, high-speed rail is going to be the future of travel. And now we're saying, wow, actually, the future of travel might just be, driverless cars, because it's so simple to get in your own car and sleep overnight when your car drives itself to Los Angeles. And then you wake up in the morning and you're there. And, of course, there'll be beds in these cars. But the point of the story is that it's radical technology is changing our world so quickly. It's not so simple to just say, oh, I'm going to structure a debt this way, or I'm going to structure state rules this way out 10, 20 years anymore. No, the world changes too quickly in 10 or 20 years. So what we need to look to is science and technology political candidates that are willing to, you know, look outside the box on how the future is going to change. And of course, that's where I'm trying to do my best as a gubernatorial candidate here in California, saying, look, I'm the science candidate. I'm looking at these things from this technological perspective. And I hope the voters will, you know, consider that when they're saying, well, maybe this person has the right ideas and this is what's going to keep California from going bankrupt here in 10 or 20 years, as well as restoring infrastructure and getting people out of poverty and making people actually have a much better life in California. Like I said, a basic income solves so many different problems. It's, you know, the federal land dividend solves the healthcare issue. It solves all the Medi-Cal issues with socialized medicine. And it solves the education problem, because all of a sudden now you have extra income to dedicate to education. These are the kinds of things that I think we need with out-of-the-box thinking. And I just wish there were more politicians across the country that were trying to use science and technology as the means to achieve better policy, instead of the same old, oh, it's taxes, it's immigration, it's Social Security. I mean, a lot of these ideas are going to be challenged dramatically by technology and science here in the next 5 and 10 years. And we're going to need new candidates to you know, push forward.
Zoltan Isfahan, it's been an excellent show. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been great talking to you.
And also, thanks, Sam Kevorkian.
Oh, thank you. It was great hosting this episode and hearing Zoltan's interesting ideas.